Hello, I'm Charles Gitonga in Nairobi, and here's what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. A billion-dollar financing plan to help African countries make their own vaccines. Is it a game changer? And a look at Michael Ossi, a popular comedian turned politician who is now Malawi's new vice president. How did he get there?
He gave a lot of speeches that made a lot of sense. He spoke fluently about the problems of the country and what the possible solutions are, but he still was known as a comedian. So there would still have been a lot of people who found it difficult to take his serious message seriously.
It's Monday, June 24th. First, we go to Namibia. After years of persecution and fear of arrest, LGBTI activist Frodo Dusab had significant reasons to celebrate last Friday. Namibia's High Court ruled that criminalizing sexual acts between men is unconstitutional. Although convictions for colonial era, sodomy, and unnatural sexual offenses have been rare in Namibia, these laws have fueled discrimination against gay men. Mr. Dusab first filed the case in June 2022 and has drawn strength from his strong Christian faith throughout his campaigning. He's also received unwavering support from his mother. I spoke with both of them, starting with Frido.
I have worked almost 20, 25 years in civil society activism, more on the side of HIV prevention, care and support, because I've been living with HIV for 25 years now. I'm also a litigant on the constitutional challenge to ask the courts in Namibia whether the sodomy law, which is a colonial law, is still constitutional and valid in our new constitutional dispensation after independence in 1991.
And Frido, 2 years after bringing this challenge to the courts in Namibia, did you ever think, rather, that the ruling was going to go the way it did?
I knew that our constitution promised equality, non-judgment dignity, and a pursuit of happiness. The constitution also states that while we are inheriting all the laws from apartheid South Africa, it is up to us as citizens, when we are aggrieved by a given law, to bring it to the courts, which are the final arbiters of human rights issues. I was fairly confident that my rights are protected under the constitution. And having engaged with government, the only option left was really to approach the courts on the matter.
Frido, I understand you're also a deeply religious man, and you practice your Christian faith, and it's very important to you. But we do know that the church is quite vocal against same-sex partnerships, and they describe such unions as sinful and against God's will. How do you navigate these two aspects of your life?
My faith and my sexuality had been a really big question, which over the years allowed me to sort of really have a much more closer relationship with Christ and to always not listen to what pastors were saying, but to go on my knees and to talk to God about what was happening in my life. As you can imagine, hearing all the negativity coming from the established churches, but also knowing that this is who I am, was not a very easy road to navigate. As a born-again Christian, I always sort of really go back to what Jesus the Christ and his message of love and his message of peace, which is overriding all the negative messages that are coming from pastors and churches who would rather selectively lift texts from the Bible as it suits them. And so after, at the age of 50, I'm pretty clear that I do not need to feel guilty about my own sexuality and sexual orientation. In fact, that if I know what I feel as a person, if God is the supreme being as my creator and who knows every feeling that I have, there is no need for me to pretend to God about who I am. And there is no need for me to pretend to church or to congregations or to those who claim to be believers who would rather judge that I am changed or to play to their tune.
I'm quite interested in, you said your mother was a missionary.
She used to be.
Tell me how that works and how she's been able to offer support, obviously, as someone who's very important to you, given her background, and I think have strong faith as well. How does that work, and how has she been able to offer support to you?
It's been a long road that me and my mother have worked together, and not always an easy one, definitely not in the beginning. She is 78 and now. She is a pensioner. She is at the moment really an ardent supporter who believes that, you know, we cannot reject people on the basis of their sexual orientation and gender identity, but rather we should walk with them, understand who they are, and bring them closer to God and to Christ. She's standing here next to me, and
I feel a little bit,
I'm speaking on her behalf, so I would rather give her the mic so that she can speak for herself to you.
Goeiemôre. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi, Mom. How are you?
I'm fine, and you?
I'm great, thank you. What I would want to hear from your mom, and thanks very much to her for being here, for speaking with us as well, how basically she's been able to offer support and how she's been guided by her faith. I understand she only speaks Afrikaans, so Frieda, yeah. I'm going to ask you to translate when she's finished what she's
saying. Yes.
Delating what I create.
What my mom says is that every parent must give their child love. When you reject your child, you push them into a violent world. But also when children are away from home, they are forced to have to do a lot of things for survival, including survival sex, including alcohol and drug abuse, and other unwanted behaviors. When the child has no place at home, no place in the church, and no place in the communities. She concluded by saying that this is not the will of God. The will of God is that every parent should act with love towards their child, and that judgment is for God, because Jesus loves everyone. So in short, that is a message from my mother.
Thanks, Frieda, and thanks to your mom.
Thank you very much for reaching out to
me. All right, bye-bye. And that's Frieda Dosab. Part of the government's arguments in opposing Frieda Dosab's case was that the public sentiment in Namibia has not evolved to the point where legislators are ready to repeal anti-homosexuality laws. Indeed, in April this year, backbencher politician Jerry Ekanju from the ruling party SWAPO declared in Parliament that Namibia should not allow Western culture to influence its citizens by allowing acts of homosexuality. We have seen a few African governments moving towards harsher anti-gay legislation with severe penalties, for example, in Uganda, while others like Tanzania, Ghana and Kenya are also considering curtailing LGBTI rights. So how conservative or liberal is the Namibian society? Christian Kilder is a senior researcher for Afrobarometer in Namibia. He was involved in a survey that looked at public attitudes towards LGBTI issues, and Namibia was actually a tolerant society, third behind Cabo Verde and South Africa.
We need to, first of all, sort of define a little bit what we mean by tolerant. In the survey research that you're referring to, there's a standard question that measures how people would feel living next to members of the LGBTQ community. So in this case, tolerance means at least I won't do anything. It's not necessarily approval. And I think there's a difference between the two that we have to understand. So when we look at the Afrobarometer data set, if we use that as a basis, then we get to this situation where, number one, there are great differences in the level of tolerance across the African continent. There's no sort of uniform feeling of either disapproval or intolerance versus tolerance. And second, Namibia, together with many other Southern African countries, make up a top 10 list when it comes to that kind of tolerance. So in that case, tolerance is at least not doing anything. The argument that it's an African situation, meaning that Africans are uniformly intolerant, the research disproves that.
And so would you say there's a clash between what society thinks in Namibia? You said tolerance, not necessarily approval. It's that people will not do anything about it if they are living next to a gay person or if they come across them in their daily interactions. So is there a clash between what the society thinks and what the government members may say, especially the older generation? Because in April, we had quite an influential figure in the ruling SWAPO party in Namibia saying that, you know, the parliament should not allow or should not allow influence from so-called, quote-unquote, Western culture, which they argue allows acts such as homosexuality. And so would you say there is a disconnect between public opinion, government members, and what the constitution says?
I think most definitely so. I think, again, to provide some context, Namibia appears among the top 10 most tolerant of the Afrobarometer sample of 39 countries. So that means that the level of public tolerance is high compared to elsewhere on the continent. And secondly, Namibia, together with Eswatini, were the only two countries within that group of top 10 with regard to public tolerance that did not have legislative reforms to get rid of the broad sort of common law provisions upon which this sort of anti-gay legislation has been built. So even in 2020, the Law Reform Commission of Namibia has already recommended that those laws be scrapped, that they're unconstitutional. But the ruling party, specifically the government, sort of build a case to say they won't enforce the legislation. And I think the reason for that is that once they started enforcing this legislation, they would expose them to the constitutional test, which is what happened last week. And I think in that sense, we have to understand Namibia is a constitutional democracy. And the government's argument that it does not want to get rid of these laws, despite the Law Reform Commission's recommendations, are based on the fact that they argue public opinion would be against it, or that it would be against the Namibian value system. And our data then clearly shows Namibia is amongst the most tolerant. And the constitutional test has now been enforced, and those laws have been found to be unconstitutional.
We've seen a lot of conversations around anti-gay legislation, whether it's in Uganda, Kenya, Ghana, in West Africa. Does this ruling in Namibia start to send signals to countries like those? Will we see other countries take note and begin to change the conversation in their own countries?
Southern Africa seems to be the most tolerant in that way compared to these others. I don't think necessarily that, say, for example, the legislation in Uganda will be changed because of a ruling in Namibia. I think that kind of situation wouldn't occur. I also think that by continuing with state-sponsored homophobia, you will find that the community, the nation may even become even more intolerant in cases like Uganda, whereas in cases where the legislation have been scrapped and things have been allowed to develop naturally, that kind of intolerance is expected to decline in even further, making tolerant countries more tolerant and making intolerant countries more intolerant.
Christian Kilder, a senior researcher with Survey Warehouse in Namibia, part of Afrobarometer. $1 billion project to fund development of vaccines in Africa has been launched. The African Vaccine Manufacturing Accelerator is a financing mechanism that will avail the funding over a period of 10 years. The goal is to produce up to 60% of the vaccines needed by African countries in Africa by the year 2040. Currently, the continent produces only 2%. To help us understand how significant this step is, my colleague Audrey Brown has been speaking to Dr. Jean Kaseya, the Director General of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Africa CDC.
Africa has to suffer from inequity during the COVID time. That one was a lesson that our leaders have to learn and to say, tomorrow, if there is any other pandemic, we need to have our own vaccines. This is the main reason they requested Africa CDC to lead this program to manufacture vaccines in Africa. But as you know, it will request a lot of funding. And for that, we started to negotiate with Gavi to put in place this accelerator called AVMA. And this is a $1 billion funding supporting African manufacturers to make sure that 2040, we can achieve some of our objectives. It means manufacturing at least 60% of our vaccines in Africa.
I was looking at the list of people that will be partners in this, and I noticed that not a single African institution or an African country is on there as one of the funders. You've got Ireland, you've got Italy, you've got the EU, you've got Germany, UK, US, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, etc., etc. Where are the African partners in this?
I'm confident that African countries, they will join that. I took the lead to announce to the head of state and all partners that Africa CDC managed to secure $2 billion from Afrexim Bank. This $2 billion will complement the $1 billion from AVMA to support local manufacturing agenda.
Are you certain that you've got the money in the bank and it's not just big talk from nations that often talk big and don't deliver?
We are making our partners accountable. We are clearly saying we need you to stick on your commitment. This is time to create this bridge to ensure that we can recreate the trust that was broken during COVID time.
Will African institutions that have been trying to upscale themselves to create, develop vaccines that are specific to local conditions be able to access this money?
Yes. Any manufacturer in Africa that can meet the requirement can have access to this funding. It means a manufacturer that will get the technology that will start to manufacture a vaccine, before this vaccine to be sold to other countries, you must get what we call the WHO, the World Health Organization pre-qualification. It means you get the standard of quality that will make all partners comfortable for the use of this vaccine. Then the second milestone will be if your vaccine reaches the level of the tender process. If buyers, they see that your price is a little bit higher than what other continents are applying, Gavi will provide funding to cover this gap, because we want African manufacturers to be competitive.
I asked you that question because when it came to, for instance, finance for climate change initiatives, many smaller initiatives and bigger ones as well were saying that the money that was pledged would be there in principle, but not in reality, and that they had to jump through very many hoops that was more suited to huge multinational organizations than smaller, more homegrown initiatives in order to access the money. So I'm just, and as a result, either the money was unused or the money disappeared down various channels that people couldn't follow, or the money was actually used by initiatives and corporations that didn't need it. So it was, in a way, compounding the problem and creating new problems and still freezing out initiatives that would benefit from it. And the reason why they were not benefiting from it is because they couldn't reach these very specific, you call them milestones, but for many people, they were just hurdles that they had to jump through that they couldn't achieve.
You are right. And as Africans, we are not naive. We said to reach the WHO pre-qualification, it's costly. This is why we are coming with this $2 billion. It means we have two ways to deal with the issue. The first one is for a manufacturer that is serious with a product that we can see this vaccine can be promising, we will use the $2 billion to support.
Can you tell me, before we go, which vaccines will be prioritized?
We have three types of vaccine. The first one is what we call the traditional vaccines, like measles and others, that our babies are getting. The second level of vaccines we are targeting are new vaccines. I'm still waiting to see malaria vaccine manufactured in Africa. Tuberculosis vaccine. We are talking about HIV vaccine. And all of these new vaccines, we are talking about HPV. And the third level of vaccines we are talking about is all vaccines against outbreaks in Africa. We cannot accept to see again our people dying from cholera, yellow fever, Ebola as well. These are vaccines we are targeting. Local manufacturing, for me, is the second independence of Africa.
Dr. Jean Kaseya, Director General, Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Africa CDC. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. And now let's talk about Michael Ussi. Ever heard of him? Well, he's a household name in Malawi, having acted in one of the most popular sitcoms in the country. And just last week, he was sworn in as vice president, following the death of Solos Chilima in a plane crash. While he's best known for his comedy, Ussi is not entirely new to politics. He was Solos Chilima's running mate in the annulled 2019 election, before Chilima joined forces with the current president, Lazarus Chakwera, in a rerun and won. Ussi joins a select group of people globally who've made the switch from comedy to politics, most notably Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky. I've been finding out more about Michael Ussi from journalist Peter Jegwa in Lilongwe.
Hi, Charles. How are you?
Good. How are you today?
I am fine.
Right. And how's Malawi?
Malawi, well, it's cold, but fine.
Yeah, so is Nairobi, quite cold, actually.
Right. Ah, okay.
So begin by telling us who Michael Ussi is.
Well, Michael Ussi came to national prominence in Malawi as an actor and a comedian. He started out acting in a long soap on national radio before we had television in Malawi. And then when television came, he migrated to television, becoming an instant hit, a very well-known person with his comedy, with the character that he was playing, very, very funny character. So for a very long time, Malawians have known Michael Ussi as a comedian. But of course, we know later on he then changed to become a politician that has become ending to where we are now.
And for people outside of Malawi, how would you describe his work as a comedian, the type of shows that he was able to appear in the Malawian media for a very long time, like you said?
A very funny character on stage. So he acted on stage many times, but also in sort of controlled environments in studio for radio. But his character, he was always very, very, very funny. But in Malawi, I think like in most of Africa, it's difficult for a person to make a living as an actor or a comedian. So he used resources from his work, where he worked, to support his acting career. And at some point, he actually got the organization he was working for to fund a drama series on radio, which was then tailored to teach people on issues of HIV and AIDS and fighting other social ills in society.
Mm. How then did he transition into politics?
That's a million-dollar question. It's difficult to say, but in one of the plays that he did, he actually did a role in which he was Malawi's first president, Hastings Banda. So he did a play where he made himself a character in the name of former President Banda, dressed like former president, which, when we look back now, perhaps is a pointer to the fact that he may already have had thoughts of going into politics and becoming a leader now. But it was around about 7-8 years ago when he started a political movement, which he called Hoja Zake Saimbidwa Mlandu, which when you translate into English loosely means that he who eats what belongs to them cannot be accused of a crime. When he started that as a political movement, many thought it was just part of his drama, that it wasn't to be taken seriously. Although he was recording voice notes and circulating them in social media, giving serious political messages, not many people took him seriously until former Vice President Saulos Chilima took him on board into his political party and made him Vice President of the UTM party, which Saulos Chilima headed. Then that is when we saw Michael Usi, the real politician, not Michael Usi, the actor that we had known him for many years.
Yeah, and in 2019 he had been nominated as running mate for the late Saulos Chilima, the late vice president. What was the reaction then from the people imagining this figure as a running mate potentially could become vice president if the late Chilima was to win the election?
Reaction was mixed in terms of his messaging, the sort of things that he was saying. He gave a lot of speeches that made a lot of sense. He spoke fluently about the problems of the country and what the possible solutions are. To that extent, he did well. But he still was someone known as a comedian. So there would still have been a lot of people who found it difficult to take his serious message seriously. So I would say that opinion was mixed. There were those who said, maybe this is the kind of guy we need, breath of fresh air into politics, while many others still were of the view that, no, he cannot be taken seriously because of his background as a comedian.
Since then, he's been a cabinet minister for 4 years, first as Minister of Tourism, Culture and Wildlife, and also most recently Minister of Natural Resources and Climate Change. How effective has he been in government?
He is in a government that I must say is not exactly enjoying the best political ratings at the moment. So he will be seen together with the rest of the government as a government that is going through a difficult period, not really being believed as a performing government. But as an individual, I wouldn't say that he can be isolated as having been particularly exceptional or poor. You know, he has been a cabinet minister like everybody else doing his job, not really outstanding, but also you cannot say that he has been faulted for the things that he has been doing in his role as minister in the two ministerial portfolios that he has held.
Yeah, and if you look at the shoes that he's come to fill, those of the late Chilima, do Malawians feel that he will be able to do that properly? Does he have as big a political persona like Chilima had?
Michael Usi was the first person to say it himself, that the shoes of former President Saulos Chilima are too big for him to fill. And many people will agree with that sentiment. Chilima was known to be a hard worker, a strict timekeeper, a professional, someone who gets it done. Michael Usi is a different kind of personality to that. He is likable in his own way as a soft-spoken person, not necessarily as an aggressive leader that Saulos Chilima was. So he is going into a role that was previously filled by someone who was loved, admired, and it would be very, very difficult for him to fill those shoes. How he is going to perform? Well, I guess it's a question of let's wait and see, but very, very big shoes for him to fill indeed.
And talking about performance then, Peter, and lastly, has he given any indication as to what his priorities as vice president are going to be?
Under Malawi law, a vice president does not really have any specific roles or functions expected to perform. Their role is to help the president, to take instructions from the president and be given assignments by the president. So how he performs also largely will depend on what sort of assignments will be given to him by President Chakwera, how much of those assignments will be given to him. So it's difficult for him from the beginning to come out and start to spell out what exactly he wants to say. That said, however, one of the things that Michael Usi said during his inauguration was that the way he looks at himself, how he wants to conduct himself in his role as vice president, he will not be worrying about the voting day. So he will not be doing things with a view to please voters. Rather, he will be worrying about judgment day. So he wants to do things that are right in his conscience for which he will be judged fairly by God rather than things that will make him to be judged fairly by the voters. He is a deeply religious man from the Seventh-day Adventist Church, so that explains why he was making references, mentioning God and why God's judgment is more important to him than the judgment that will be passed by voters.
That's Peter Jegwa in Lilongwe. And that's Focus on Africa today. This podcast was produced by Rob Wilson and Bella Hassan in London. Franny Joey was in Nairobi. Patricia Whitehorn was in charge. And Chris Ablakwa was a technical producer. Our editors are Alice Muthengi and Andre Lombard. I'm Charles Gitonga. Speak again soon.